Well, I think one thing we're going to do right out of the gate is define what pro-life is.
Scott Klusendorf talking about his presentation at the 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
That term is now being confused. It's being put up for grabs, and we're going to make clear what the pro-life syllogism is, how we can make that case for life with people who don't accept biblical authority, who maybe don't even know what it is we stand for, and are subject to being confused. So there's a crying need to clarify what pro-life means, what our actual arguments are, and then we'll look at five bad ways people argue against the pro-life case in the public square so that we can be prepared to give good, solid, Christ-honoring answers.
You can meet and hear Scott Klusendorf making the case for life at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th in Collinsville, Illinois. Learn more about conference speakers and topics and register at issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is one of those discoveries, if it proves to be what it looks like, that may shed a lot of light on the life of an ancient people, in this case, Canaanite people. Canaanites, you know the name if you've looked at your Old Testament, and there's some overlap between its location and its time with the Old Testament. Certainly a lot of overlap in terms of the history. Nine skeletons discovered in a 3,600-year-old tomb that could be the Canaanite elite of Megiddo. Where is Megiddo and why is it important? We will find out as we talk with Dr. Craig Evans on this Thursday afternoon. He's a distinguished professor of Christian origins and dean of the School of Christian Thought at Houston Baptist University, author of several books, including Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence. Dr. Evans, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd. Good to be back with you.
Why is the location alone of this discovery pretty important?
It's very important because it is a key location for two reasons at least, perhaps more. One of them is its trade routes. It's at a key point that links the north on into Assyria and beyond, and then south on into Egypt. And so Israel always was a bit of a land bridge between these two major imperial centers, one to the north and northeast, and one to the south in Egypt. And so Megiddo is in the middle. It's at that midway point. But militarily, it has great significance, too. It's up on a hill. It's fortified. Every time it got destroyed, it got rebuilt, in antiquity, because it was just so strategic. So it was a fort. It was large. It was well protected. It was strategically located. And later on in Old Testament, New Testament prophecy, it even becomes a key location from a prophetic point of view. It becomes none other than the famous Mountain of Megiddo, Har Megiddo, which becomes known as Armageddon. So this thing is important in history, for military, for trade, for communication, and also even for the prophetic imagery on into the future.
Who were the Canaanites?
Well, the Canaanites were local indigenous tribes in the land of Canaan, which is how it was called. There was more than just a single tribe, the Canaanites, but a number of other groups in what makes up today's Israel, or what people often mean by the Holy Land. And so we've often wondered, well, who exactly were these tribes? Where'd they come from? And this particular discovery provides us, that we're talking about, provides us with nine very well-preserved skeletons, which do preserve some DNA, bone marrow, and so on, which means it's possible we can improve our ethnic mapping from antiquity. And that alone could shed some light on what was going on in the land of Canaan just prior to the arrival of the Hebrew tribes, which, of course, formed Israel. And that's what the dating of this is so significant. The dating is put at about 3,600 years ago, about 1600 BC. That's probably a century or so prior to the Exodus. And the DNA evidence so far suggests, and the name of, in one of the letters carved in stone that's been found or pressed into clay and baked, suggests that it could be an incursion from another ethnic tribe into the area, which may have destabilized the land of Canaan and all the Canaanites just prior to Israel's arrival. So this could be significant in our understanding of this important land before Israel took possession of it.
How unusual is it to find a cache of skeletons like this, 9 of them?
Oh, it's not that unusual to find a tomb like that with several well-preserved skeletons. Of course, we're always really happy when that happens because the forensic evidence has not been contaminated. But more often than not, we find tombs that have been robbed in antiquity and or in the modern times. The bones are crushed, scattered about. We can't even get a proper body count. We can't do anthropological studies and postmortems, you know, things like that. In this case, everybody's laid out, and there they are. And so the history of the tomb, the history of the burial, you know, there were 3 skeletons or 3 bodies placed in there, and then sometime later the remains were pushed deeper into the burial crypt, and 6 more persons were put in. We can do DNA, and of course, there's reason to believe these people might all be from the same family. They're clearly upper class, judging by the jewelry and other things that they were buried with. So again, this gives us an idea of society. It gives us an idea of economics, politics, chain of command, and other important features.
How is the date of 3,600 years old usually determined? What are the factors that go into making that kind of judgment?
Well, there are several things that can give us a date. And so when we say 3,600 years ago or 1,600 BC, it's not a number pulled out of the hat. We actually have some correspondence, and almost always correspondence, especially of this nature, where somebody, an official, is writing to none other than the Pharaoh of Egypt, that you're going to have a date. And so that almost gives us an exact day, month, and year. We also have pottery typology. We have typology that can be inferred also from types of jewelry. So we have 3-4 different indices, just the way the crypt is put together. The crypt is part of a building complex that surrounds it and is above it. So all of these factors come into play. So I'm talking stratigraphy, typology involving jewelry, typology involving ceramics, and then, of course, what looks like dated correspondence. So that's a pretty firm number. I don't think we're off on that.
The coverage of this makes reference to kind of several waves of warfare from Egypt that are in evidence in history. Talk about those.
Well, that's why Megiddo has the shape that it has. You know, when you look at pictures of it or visit it, I've been there many times. And it was a bit of a hill, which is why people built on it in the first place. But then the city gets wrecked, and then somebody builds on top of it again. It gets wrecked. They build on top of it again. So you get a whole bunch of layers, and the hill gets higher and higher up, which means that it's easier and easier to defend it. So that indicates that, you know, even though it got destroyed, obviously it was captured and destroyed several times, yet they kept building there. Why? Because it is the best spot to be. As I said at the top of the interview, you know, it's a strategic location for trade routes, communication, and military purposes. And even though it wasn't invincible and could be captured, you still wanted to build there because it was the best place for this area, and so it was strategic. We want to know, I think, from a point of view of Israel's history, we want to know the extent of Egypt's influence over the area. Egypt often controlled the land of Canaan or parts thereof. Yet, in the biblical story, the Israelites succeed in leaving Egypt. They are out and about for like 40 years in the Sinai Desert, and then finally enter into this land, this very land. At Megiddo, I should have said earlier, is about 75 miles due north of Jerusalem. So that gives you an idea where it is. And the Jewish people, or the Israelites, enter this land and conquer it. Well, somehow they were able to do that. So this suggests that Egypt's power had receded. Egypt was not projecting power very far into the north. And the northern empires, such as they were, the Medes, the Babylonians, Syrians, and others, we're not projecting power and influence very far south. And so Megiddo's in this key point, Jerusalem and Megiddo, right there where the tribes are of Israel. It's almost like a power vacuum. So we want to understand, we want to explain that, because that's just not the way it has been in history. You got one power or the other, ebbing and flowing, pushing and shoving, Egypt pushing north, Assyria or other eastern powers pushing south, and yet the tribes of Israel somehow only had to compete with the Canaanites, the Philistines, and others, establish their kingdom, and maintained that kingdom for hundreds of years. How did they do that? And this kind of a discovery, this kind of stratigraphy, layering down, digging through the tell, seeing the burned layers, the destruction layers, this helps us piece together the history and figure out how it is Israel managed to establish itself and survive.
So in this tug of war for this territory from north and south, there is a period of time coinciding with the entrance of the children of Israel into the land and the conquest that followed and their establishment of a kingdom such as it was, where that tug of war rope is slack. They have a window of opportunity, so to speak.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's a way of putting it. It didn't mean that Israel had an easy time of it, even when they overpowered the smaller tribal chieftains and kingdoms that were already there, whenever that was, and you know, probably at a period of about 1500 B.C. until David and Saul, around 1000 B.C., finally exerted themselves enough to just conquer the entire area. There had to be some kind of a political and military vacuum for them to do that and get away with it. But not long after it, probably by 800 or so B.C., so that would mean the Davidic kingdom is barely 200 years old, then Egypt and Assyria once again are beginning to assert themselves and pushing and pushing, and Israel is like caught in the jaws of a vise. And that's where the Old Testament prophets begin talking, because the temptation was always for the kings of Israel to compromise, to strike bargains, either with the Egyptians as potential allies or an enemy, or the Assyrians in the north. And compromising with them, it usually meant selling out and going along with their gods. And of course, then prophets like Isaiah, you know, and others would rise up and say, quit doing that if you violate your covenant with God. Fornicate, commit adultery, as it were, with these pagan deities, these idols, then God will eject you from the land that he gave you. So that's a common message of the prophets, and of course this helps us understand the political backdrop, the political reality that these Israelite kings faced as they're juggling, you might say, geopolitical power, politics, and pragmatics on the one hand, and then the religious ideals of their monotheism on the other.
Dr. Craig Evans is Distinguished Professor of Christian Origins and Dean of the School of Christian Thought at Houston Baptist University, and author of several books, including Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence. When you purchase this book using the Amazon link at our website, a percentage of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Listen on Demand, look for Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence. Dr. Evans, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd. Always great to be with you.
When we come back in Hour 2 of Issues Etc., Pastor Paul McCain joins us for our ongoing series on the Lutheran Confessions. Part 9 on the Apology of the Augsburg Confession. We'll be picking up the subject of repentance. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Do you want a church with a rockin' band and a sermon series to help you live a better life? It's not here. Bethany Evangelical Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights offers authentic, historic Christianity to a world awash in fads and entertainment. and offers forgiveness of sins to people overwhelmed with guilt and shame. Join us Sundays at 9:30 on Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights, Illinois, to receive the life-giving gifts of God with us. Find out more online at bethanylcms.org.